So I have some good news and some bad news. No, we're going to give the good news first. The good news is that the study of the recent Panama Papers has determined conclusively that the Thomistic Institute does not, I underscore, does not have an illegal offshore fund. The bad news is we also don't have a legal offshore fund. In fact, we just don't have that much funds. So, I'm happy to see, by the way, there's some of our benefactors here today, and we're very grateful. You have on your seat here contact information in case you want to be on our email list, but also an opportunity to help support our cause. And we are very grateful for benefactions, whether they be great or small, and no gift is too small. It's very helpful to us to continue doing the kind of things that we're doing here today. So if you want to make any kind of donation, you can give that to myself, to Father Legg, to Beatrice Delgadillo, or to Peter Blair, the four of us here. And now I'd like to welcome Mary Eberstadt to introduce our next speaker.
Thank you. Thank you, Father Thomas Joseph, Father Sebastian, Rusty Reno, and everybody else who's here today. It's always a great pleasure to be around like-minded brothers, figurative and literal, and sisters. Introducing George Weigel to an audience full of Catholics is like introducing Lady Gaga at the Music Video Awards. A more known and esteemed quantity doesn't exist in the situation. And even George knows this, in fact, because I emailed him this morning to say, is there anything in particular you would like me to mention, any of your books, etc.? And he wrote back, my skill at second base back in the day. So, like most of us, I've been learning from George all my adult life. I will learn more when he stops writing faster than most of us can read. It's a great truth to say that we depend on him as no one else, and it is a great pleasure to call him friend, George.
Thank you, Mary, and good afternoon, everyone. I suppose in terms of the nomenclature quarrels, I'm the vetero-Catholic here, not the neo-Catholic. But that's only because I've become eligible for Medicaid a week from today. Medicare a week from today. Yeah, right, whatever. One of those things they send you lots of paper on. Wonderful to be back at the NYU Catholic Center. I haven't been here for years. And to see this flourishing is a great sign of vitality here in the church in New York. So let me thank Father Thomas Joseph, Father Dominic, everyone else involved in this, for all of this great work. What I was going to say to Mary, I think I said it to her over the phone the other day when she keeps prodding me for these, you know, how shall I introduce you? I said, well, given what I'm going to say, perhaps you could call me the love child of Jeremiah and Cassandra here. Because if you thought Phil Munoz was being a little dour, I'm going to be even more dour, although I hope a bit uplifting at the end. But the Second Vatican Council in the Pastoral Constitution, the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes, invites us to read the signs of the times so that we can be the missionary disciples we've all been baptized to be. And so I thought what I would do is try to describe the cultural situation in which the Catholic Church finds itself in the United States today, using two templates. The first drawn from Father John Courtney Murray in the book We Hold These Truths, and the second drawn from the principles of Catholic social doctrine as developed by St. John Paul II. Father Murray, as many of you know, described the United States as a proposition country and identified what he called four truths on which the American democratic experiment rests. The first of those truths was that God is sovereign over nations as well as individuals, and that sovereignty is expressed in a universal moral law that can be known by reason. The second of those truths extended the medieval concept, the medieval Catholic concept, that there is an inherent sense of justice in the people, who therefore should be able to give consent in governance through participation, that participation protected by legally affirmed civil and political rights. So the sovereignty of God, the principle of consent. The third truth was that society is prior to the state, and the state exists to serve society, not the other way around. And the fourth was, of course, that only a virtuous people can be free in a genuinely human sense of freedom. So, how fares the American Republic measured by this template? I think the answer has to be not too well. On the first proposition, the sovereignty of the first truth, the sovereignty of God over nations as well as over individuals, the problem is not so much the new atheists. I think their 15 minutes of fame has run out. The problem is what Murray himself quoted from Romano Guardini, who spoke of what he called the interior disloyalty of modern times, which our First Things colleague David Bentley Hart has called metaphysical boredom, a kind of boredom with the very mystery of being itself. This boredom, of course, gives birth to nihilism, simply not caring. And that nihilism, raised to a first principle of political organization, of course, yields what Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger called on April 18th, 2005, the dictatorship of relativism. That nihilism also manifests itself in the claim frequently heard now, not least in this wretched presidential campaign, that those moral truths that we believe can be known by reason, in fact, are matters of irrational bigotry. What we understand to be moral truths inscribed in the world and into us, truths that we can know by reflection on the human condition, John Paul II would say, by reflection on the dynamics of human moral action. Far too many of our fellow countrymen think of those as exercises in irrational bigotry, without reflecting upon the fact that to so describe them puts them on the other side of Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address, and most recently Martin Luther King in Letter from Birmingham Jail, which explicitly refers to the natural moral law as standing in judgment over the positive law of states, counties, countries, etc. As to Murray's principle of consent, or the truth that the people having an inherent sense of justice have the right to be consulted in the way they are governed and consent to that governance, what we called in First Things, creating quite a fuss, I think 20 years ago now, time flies when you're having fun. The judicial usurpation of politics is familiar to all of us. Roe versus Wade was a particularly obnoxious and obscene example of this, even called by Justice Potter Stewart an exercise in raw judicial power. it's a sign of something that the argumentation in the Obergefell decision of last summer, imposing a regime of anyone can marry anyone on the entire country, was argued by Justice Kennedy in terms that make Justice Blackmun in Roe versus Wade look like James Madison in by comparison. A sheer appeal to sentimentality and to a really bizarre notion of the human person that I'll get to in a moment. But I think in addition to that familiar judicial usurpation of politics problem is eroding the truth of consent and participation that Murray identified as part of that constellation of truths that make up the American proposition. We now, after the past 9 months, have to speak as well of the vulgarization of politics by the mass media and on the internet, which led to a very fine, if very sobering, op-ed piece by my friend Joe Epstein in the Wall Street Journal, I think on Wednesday. Many of you have seen it. There were five pictures: the burn, the hill, Ted, Donald, the Donald, and Kasich. And the headline was, "Is this the best we can do?" And the piece was a very striking one. There are 330 million people in this country. I mean, is this really the best we can do? And then Joe explored why he thinks that may be the case, unhappily, and it's simply because of this vulgarization problem. I mean, and he pointed to someone that I think many of us would regard as perhaps as qualified as anybody to be president of the United States these days, former Governor Mitch Daniels of Indiana, who just simply said, "I'm not doing this because I'm not putting my family through this." Period. This is a real problem. This is a problem in this template along that truth of consent and participation. Because if the best of us aren't coming forward to offer themselves for leadership, we're being asked to consent to sloppy seconds or worse. The third truth in the constellation of the American proposition that society is prior to the state, and the state exists to serve society, not the other way around, is, of course, as already mentioned by Phil and Rusty, manifestly in trouble from the assault on civil society institutions, of which the attack on the Little Sisters of the Poor is the icon. We have been governed for 7 years by a cast of characters, most of whom most of us have never heard of, because they are so deeply embedded in the federal bureaucracy, particularly at an agency like the Department of Health and Human Services, who really don't believe in civil society, who really believe there is the state and the individual, the autonomous individual, and everything in between is simply in the way. And the more you can pressure what's in the way off to the margins, the better off things will be. As for that fourth part of the proposition, that only a virtuous people can be free, there are so many problems there that one could spend the rest of the afternoon cataloging them. I would just highlight the notion that the democratic political process, or the free economy for that matter, are simply matters of mechanics. All you got to do is get the machinery right, put in the ignition key, turn it over, and the machine runs by itself. Well, as Jean-Paul II taught us in Centes et Moissonis 25 years ago, democracy and the market are not machines that can run by themselves. The whole premise of the Catholic social doctrine tradition, but given particularly fine development by Jean-Paul II, is that it takes a certain kind of people. There has to be a critical mass of people living certain virtues to make that machinery, no matter how well designed, work. And I think that's part of the point that Professor Munoz was making in talking about good decisions and good families and all of it. Another example of this deterioration of the fourth leg on the Murray stool is the way in which two words, choice and fair, have become the trump cards of trump cards in our political discourse. With no, and here's perhaps the best example of the drop, how teleology drops out of the picture, no examination of the question, choose what? No, finish the sentence. What are you choosing here? And then, of course, the raising of the true F word, fair, to this authoritarian end the discussion. Hey, where does that come from? It comes from every three-year-old in the world. That's not fair. That's not fair, Daddy. Okay, that's the infantilization of our politics. And then, of course, perhaps particularly worth mentioning on a great university campus like this, is the deterioration of tolerance into the rawest forms of intolerance. And the enforcement of that by all sorts of mechanisms, some of them legal, some of them cultural, interpersonal, professional, etc. So, measured by the Murray template, we're doing not so good. What about looking at our situation through the lens of Catholic social doctrine? Well, I take it there are four core principles of the social doctrine. Personalism, the common good, subsidiarity, and solidarity. Personalism meaning that all right thinking about society, polity, economy, and culture begins with the inalienable dignity and value of the individual human person. It doesn't begin with the racial group, the ethnic group, the gender group, the social status group, etc. It begins with the individual human person who is the bearer of built-in dignity, which is given public expression in civil and political rights, which is immediately complemented by Leo XIII in Rerum Novarum with the principle of the common good. I should exercise my freedom in such a way that it's not simply for my self-aggrandizement, it's for the good of the commons. Subsidiarity, of course, Pius XI, 1931 encyclical, Quadragesimo Anno. Decision-making should be left at the lowest level in a social hierarchy commensurate with achieving the common good, American federalism being one expression of that. And then John Paul II's fourth principle down in the foundations of the social doctrine, the principle of solidarity, or what Jacques Maritain would have called civic friendship, which put negatively means that there has to be some sense of moral obligation in a community beyond legal obligation for that community to function as an organized political community in history. If all we know about each other is how we can sue each other, this is insufficient. And of course, New York, I think, knows the truth of this in its bones from 15 years ago, when on 9/11, remarkable acts of bravery were performed by people who did not know whom they were trying to save, but did so out of a profound sense of that solidarity. Well, how are we doing on that front? Well, not too good. What the social doctrine calls personalism has become a wildly distorted individualism in our political culture and our public culture, detached from any sense of connection or obligation. And the Obergefell decision, or the Kennedy opinion in the Obergefell decision, was perhaps, one hesitates to say, the ne plus ultra, or the bottom of the barrel, or whichever, up or down, because it could always get worse, you know? But it's something deeply disturbing there. I mean, what is the portrait of the human person that underwrites that decision. We are each twitching bundles of desires, and the primary function of the state is to facilitate the satisfaction of those desires. Again, a kind of infantilization of the notion of democratic citizenship. That's not what the social doctrine of the church means by personalism. As for the common good, identity politics, it seems to me, is a profound assault upon the principle of the common good. Not so much in the name of a distorted individualism, but in the name of a racial group, a gender group, some sub-tribe or other. In my state of Maryland, for example, the People's Republic of Maryland, one of the two candidates for the Senate seat, being held and being vacated by my old sociology teacher, Barbara Mikulski, confessions are being heard afterwards, is running primarily on the basis that she is a single mother African-American woman. That is her claim. We need that in the United States. That little identity sub-tribe is not represented. Well, look, I am very glad she brought her child into this world and apparently is raising him quite well. But the claim that that set of box tickings in terms of identity constitutes a qualification for office, and no one says anything about that. The guy who's running against her, who's very scary simply because he's Nancy Pelosi's protege, but he's actually competent, and therefore much scarier than his mistress. Does not say, no, he just says, well, I'll do better by single mothers of color than she will. This is a very strange new thing. The principle of subsidiarity, I think, while we're beating up on Woodrow Wilson, let's give him another kick while he's down here, has been very severely eroded in our midst by the Leviathan state, which has now gotten, in fact, far worse than the judicial usurpation of politics. It's now the bureaucratic usurpation of politics. This vast bureaucratic array, this regulatory world of really unaccountable civil servants who have, among other things, created the Little Sisters of the Poor mess. This is a real deterioration of subsidiarity. And then, of course, solidarity is being eroded by the tribalism I just mentioned, as well as a phenomenon that I think, frankly, many of us have not taken seriously enough, and that is what Charles Murray has been calling for 15 years now. This was referenced earlier, the coming apart phenomenon. That we are becoming two societies basically defined not racially, but by, you know, competence and incompetence. Ability to cope and flourish in the world of the 21st century and an absolute inability to do that. And that's a very serious challenge for the church. I mean, what Pope Francis calls the peripheries are now, you know, not just peripheral. There's a very large number of people in our country who feel they have no real future, and that is eroding social solidarity very severely. What about the specific contributions of John Paul II to the social doctrine, particularly in the encyclical of the encyclical Centesimus Annus? The first of those was this very finely balanced portrait of what the Pope always called the free and virtuous society. He would never just say the free society, but the free and virtuous society is having three interlocking parts. For those of you of my generation, think of the old Ballantine beer label, you know, with the three rings. You Gen X people, you don't have that. There are no craft beers with three rings on them. The three rings were, of course, a democratic political community, a free economy, and a vibrant public moral culture. And then the second point he made was that it's the culture that's the key to the rest, because it's the culture that produces the kind of people who can make the machinery of democracy and the market work so that the end is genuine human flourishing. This obviously implies a notion of freedom that is much thicker than the freedom celebrated by the great moral philosopher Frank Sinatra in the tune, I Did It My Way. Freedom ordered to goodness, freedom tethered to truth, freedom, to cite Father Pinkers again, freedom for excellence, not the freedom of indifference. Then, of course, John Paul talked in Centesimus Annus about the absolutely crucial role of the institutions of civil society in the free and virtuous society of the 21st century, and spoke particularly about the importance of the family, something we've been thinking about this week in a special way, as the first school of freedom. A very suggestive phrase. What did he mean by that? He meant simply that every two-year-old in the history of humanity is a natural-born tyrant. Beautiful little bundle of willfulness. I want it, and I want it now. The next break, I'll be happy to show you pictures of my 9-month-old granddaughter, who's a beautiful expression of this. What turns all of the little tyrants into citizens, into democratic citizens who can make this kind of a polity work with others? Well, the first place we learn to do that is in the first school of freedom, which is the family. But other civil society institutions, from schools to churches to the scouts to all sorts of voluntary associations, are other schools of freedom. And then finally there was Centesimus Annus's very suggestive and prescient notion that wealth in the 21st century would be a matter of creativity and entrepreneurship, and therefore poverty should be understood as exclusion from the circles of productivity and exchange, where that creativity is given economic form. How are we doing against that template? Well, again, you know, some problems. I think there's still a lot of entrepreneurial juice left in the United States, but I think there is very little sense of work as vocation, which was another classic theme in the social magisterium of John Paul II, who in fact was the first pope in a very long time who had actually done real hard work, real manual labor, and it was a very formative influence in his life. And he came out of that both as poet and as philosopher with something that was quite new in at least popular Catholic thinking about work. When I was a boy growing up in Baltimore, the catechism explanation of why we had to work was a result of original sin. Remember that? Adam and Eve didn't make a mess of things all holiday, all the time. This was never serious theology, but it was the way things were presented. It was all their fault. John Paul II had a very different idea of this. He spoke passionately about work as our participation in God's ongoing creativity in the world. Thomas Aquinas, not unfamiliar to some people here, famously said that if God wanted to end the world, God would not have to do something, God would have to stop doing something. Okay? Well, our participation in that ongoing divine creativity is work, which means that work should be thought as of in vocational terms, not simply in career terms, not simply in wage-earning terms, but vocational terms. I don't sense a lot of that in our country today, although I do sense more and more of it among well-formed Catholic young people, and that's a good sign. As for the centrality of the public moral culture to the correct functioning of the market and democracy, well, that, of course, has eroded to the point where a candidate for president of the United States can boast of the magnitude of what St. Paul once called, would have called his less honorable parts. And the response is either laughter or boredom or a yawn. Okay, so he's a vulgarian, so what? 5 years ago, I don't think that would have been the case. Certainly not 10, 20 years ago, even though all sorts of shenanigans have been going on in American politics all the time. I can take you to a Catholic retreat center in Northern Virginia where Lyndon Baines Johnson used to take one of his paramours on the weekend. I mean, that is not new. What's new is the public vulgarization of all of this. And this is just very bad. And I think it's an expression in the political culture of popular culture. It's an expression of popular culture. As for culture, democracy, and market, I think too much of our country, too much of our fellow countrymen do think of democracy and the market as self-running machines, and then wonder why when they don't seem to work so well. Well, maybe the premise needs to be re-examined. The Sinatra problem of freedom I've already mentioned. The attack on civil society we've already described, but certainly the deconstruction of the family, the notion that family can mean anything we want it to mean, as marriage can mean anything we want it to mean, is surely not a good sign for the future of civil society. And while welfare reform has made, I think, some difference in our inner urban areas, it hasn't made the culture-changing difference that is so crucial there. I mentioned growing up in Baltimore a year ago when the city was burning after the Freddie Gray death. I wrote a piece saying we've heard an awful lot about Freddie Gray's mother and her suffering, which I certainly understand and sympathize with. Why haven't we heard a word about Freddie Gray's father, or the father of all of these other kids who are burning down everything from the Dahman Mall to the Inner Harbor? Whatever else welfare reform has done, it has not addressed in any way the extraordinary crisis of the breakdown of family, of marriage in the family in our inner urban areas, which I think can only be addressed by something on the scale of the Wesleyan revolution that altered patterns of behavior in those social cohorts in 18th century England. So it's really not a very pretty picture. But here's a way to think about that that may help us through. It comes from the ninth paragraph of the Dogmatic Constitution on the Church of the Second Vatican Council, where the Council Fathers write, "It was Christ who established this new covenant, the New Testament in his blood, calling into being from Jews and Gentiles, a people that was to form a unity in the Spirit as the new people of God. This messianic people, though it does not in fact embrace all mankind and often seems to be a tiny flock, is yet the enduring source of unity, hope, and salvation for the whole human race. It is established by Christ as a communion of life, of love, and of truth. It is also used by him as an instrument for the redemption of all, and is sent out into the world as the light of the world and the salt of the earth. The Catholicism in 21st century America that can address these extraordinary problems of culture, which we've been describing here this afternoon, the kind of church that can give our country a new birth of freedom, rightly understood, is a church that has truly internalized that view of itself. Seems to be a tiny flock, but is yet the enduring source of unity, hope, and salvation for the whole human race, established by Christ as a communion of life, love, and truth, and his instrument for the redemption of all, sent to be light and salt. This means thinking about the Catholic Church in the 21st century in this country and in similarly situated countries in the North Atlantic world in a new way. I've described that in a book that some of you may be familiar with as Evangelical Catholicism. John Paul II called it the Church of the New Evangelization. Pope Francis calls it a church permanently in mission. It's a church in which each of us understands that on the day of our baptism, okay, here we'll do the quiz, how many of you know the date of your baptism? 5%, that's a little higher than the norm. Look, you know your birthday. If you're married, you better know your wedding anniversary, gentlemen, or you're in deep trouble. Go home tonight, get out the file where you keep the Catholic paper, and look up the date of your baptism. And then celebrate that every day, because that is the day you received a commission that is expressed in the 28th chapter of St. Matthew's Gospel. Go into the world making disciples of all nations. That was spoken to you through the instrument of the sacrament on the day of your baptism. This baptismally centered, eucharistically fed, penitentially renewed evangelical Catholicism seems to me the only Catholicism with a future. And it's certainly the only Catholicism that is capable of addressing these problems. Why do I stress baptism so much? Part of it is simply reflecting on 25 years of experience, now almost 30, with evangelical Protestants in Washington. When I first started meeting with them on pro-life and religious freedom issues then meant getting priests and nuns out of the gulag. It didn't mean keeping the Little Sisters of the Poor out of leg irons. I found that these people had a very interesting way of introducing themselves at meetings. You know, 12 Americans get together, nobody knows who anybody is. You introduce yourself by what? What do you do? You know, I'm John Smith, I'm a lawyer, I'm Jane Doe, I'm a pediatrician, I'm so-and-so, I do this. Everybody introduces themselves by what they do. This is not how these people did this. There'd be 15 of them and one of me, and they'd go around, and I'm John Smith, and I was born again on, and they'd name a date when they were an adult. And I'm Jane Doe, and I was born again on. So it would come around to me. I can be a contrarian on occasion. And I would say, I'm George Weigel, and I was born again on April 29th, 1951, at which point I was precisely 12 days old. You may all get the birthday card ready, since I just gave you the hint. Okay, that got some interesting discussions about sacramental theology going with these people. But the import of that really came home to me when I was working on the first volume of the John Paul II biography, Witness to Hope, and I was describing his first visit back to Wadowice, the little town 40 kilometers or so outside Krakow, where he was born and grew up. And what did he do there? He goes back in those remarkable 9 days in 1979, and he goes to the parish church where he had been an altar boy, made his first communion, been confirmed, blah, blah, blah. He goes straight to the parish church and goes straight to the baptismal font, kneels down, and kisses it. Why? Because he knew that was the most important day of his life. Not the day he was ordained a priest, not the day he was consecrated a bishop, not the day he was elected pope. The most important day of his life was the day he received that missionary disciple commission. Now, there are 70-some million Catholics in this country, at least officially. Probably a lot more than that, unofficially. If a fifth, a quarter of those 70 million people said to themselves every day, what am I going to do to exercise that missionary discipleship? We would have a very, very powerful movement indeed. And we would have a movement capable of giving the country the new birth of freedom it badly needs. If we want to understand the deep distress that seems to be abroad in the land in these days, I don't think we have to look any farther than into the mirror. We are the bearers of the most compelling, coherent, comprehensive vision of the free and virtuous society in the 21st century that is on offer anywhere in the world. It's ours. But we have not received that vision as we ought, and we have not communicated as well as we ought the view of the human person and human communities on which that vision rests, and the country is very much worse off for that. So the challenge to all of us here, Catholic leaders in New York, Catholic leaders throughout the United States, is to vigorously deploy this vision of the free and virtuous society according to the principles of the social doctrine in revitalizing the human ecology that makes democracy and prosperity possible. And that will only happen if each of us owns the truth of our baptism, owns the fact of our missionary discipleship, and measures the quality of that discipleship by the question, how many others have I introduced into this communion that often seems to be a tiny flock, but is yet the enduring source of unity, hope, and salvation for the whole human race. Thank you.